Emotions Matter. Brought to you by EMAW.com. That's EMAWW.com. Your solution for emotional intelligence. Thank you for joining me, your host, Monique, on the Emotions Matter podcast. It is my pleasure to introduce a former Emotions Matter podcast guest, Ms. Jenny Florence, who previously shared with us her insight from her number one international bestseller book, 7 Steps to Spiritual Empathy. Jenny is a well-respected, accredited counselor and therapist for over 26 years, who is committed to helping others by providing resources to help them find a greater sense of emotional awareness. She is also the founder of A to Z of Emotional Wellness, a public resource for emotional meditations. Today, we will be focusing on her newest book, Mindfulness Meets Emotional Awareness. And now, I'd like to welcome Jenny Florence. Welcome back, Jenny.
Thank you, Monique. Thank you very much for having me back.
Oh, absolutely. We're thrilled that you're able to join us again so that we can start talking about your new book. So let's just dive right into that. Tell us, how does Mindfulness Meets Emotional Awareness differ from your first book, 7 Steps to Spiritual Empathy?
Well, in some ways, there are some similarities between them. However, it's actually a very different book. Now, the first book, 7 Steps to Spiritual Empathy, is a step-by-step guide to learn how to develop your skills in empathy in ways that are way more than just developing listening skills where we sit and we offer that empathic space to someone else. Spiritual empathy is really about learning primarily to listen to ourselves and to listen to life itself. Now, Mindfulness Meets Emotional Awareness is a step on from that, because once we really learn to listen to ourselves, especially to our emotions, we then really need to develop an ability to understand our emotions, particularly the more challenging ones, so that we can use them to enhance our ability to live a really vibrant and a really full and alive kind of life.
Now, in your new book, you do offer a number of exercises after each chapter. How do you suggest they be approached?
Well, this is the format, actually, of this entire series of books. In every chapter, there is always an invitation or an exercise that follows, because when we learn conceptual information, I mean, there's some fabulous stuff out there that we can learn and we can read about, but we actually need to learn to integrate concepts into our real daily lives so that they have a real impact. And so the exercises and the invitations after every chapter in all of these books actually enable you to integrate the knowledge that you've just learned into a real pragmatic, practical way in your daily living. Now, with 7 Steps to Spiritual Empathy, it really is a step-by-step journey of learning to develop empathy as a core sort of foundational skill in your life. Now, in Mindfulness Meets Emotional Awareness, aside from, I guess, a starting point of integrating mindfulness with emotional awareness, it's slightly different, because I've taken our most challenging emotions and I have really talked about how we can use them in a way that is positive rather than negative. And so if you were, for example, having particular problems with anxiety, you might actually return to the exercise on anxiety and, you know, use that time and again in different situations and in different circumstances, you know, until you really kind of crack it, until you actually manage to reduce your anxiety and find that you're no longer, you know, struggling with that particular emotion. I mean, likewise with disappointment or with anger. So the exercises in this particular book, you can read the whole book and just deepen your emotional awareness, or you can return to the exercises in individual chapters if you're struggling with a particular emotion.
Now, you mention anxiety as being one of the challenging emotions. Can you give us an overview of what the other challenging emotions are that you focus on in this book?
Okay, well, in this book, I've taken what I would consider to be the most common emotional states that people really struggle with, the emotions that I've come up against with people I work with, and of course in my own life too. So anxiety and fear, shame and guilt, anger and aggression, disappointment, that's a biggie for a lot of people. It can be a really huge derailer. Despair, sadness, envy, and jealousy. So these are the emotions I've taken in this particular book. And I've really talked about how to use them in a way that is valuable, you know, why we have them. Because a lot of people would sort of, I can think, and so many people have come into my practice room and said, you know, if I could never feel fear again, you know, that would be marvelous, you know, if you can just take that away. And I kind of say to them, well, actually, if you have no fear, you know, you're not going to look right and left before you cross the road. You just won't worry about it. You'll have no sense of impending danger if you're actually in a dangerous situation. You know, we need these emotions, but we need to learn how to use them and how to kind of manage them when we need them and not carry them around when we don't need them.
You describe all of these emotions as being both healthy and unhealthy. Can you perhaps focus on one or two of the emotions as an example, or just give us an overview of what you mean? And you've sort of done that a little bit with this idea of fear, but can you go a little bit further into that?
Absolutely. I mean, let's, as we've started talking about fear, I'll say a little bit about that and then maybe touch on a couple of others. Fear is an interesting emotion because I think one of the biggest problems with both fear and anxiety is that as human beings, we feel fear and appropriately so. If you were in a dangerous situation, I mean, if a car came careering down, you know, off the road, you need to be afraid. It's telling you to get out of the way, you know. We need emotions. We need these challenging emotions. The difficulty is that with something like fear or anxiety, we tend, you know, the volume of that emotion gets turned up and we're not very good at turning it back down again. So people who struggle with anxiety, you'll often find that the intensity of that emotion never kind of returns to a sort of a neutral position. So once they start to feel afraid, they tend to then become more afraid and more afraid and more afraid or more anxious. And so in many ways, we really do need to learn to turn the volume back down when we no longer need to feel that emotion. So in that particular chapter, there's some exercises that talk you through how to do this in a really pragmatic way. I mean, another emotion, if we're thinking about the healthy and the unhealthy, I mean, guilt is a tremendously valuable emotion to us, and yet it has a really bad press. You know, guilt obviously is not healthy if it's used to manipulate someone, or indeed if we use it to kind of batter ourselves inwardly. I mean, lots of people, you know, can deliver a guilt trip on themselves. But, you know, without guilt, we have no conscience. If you were to pick up a newspaper, I can guarantee if you read half a dozen pages, you'll come across several examples, I'm sure, of instances where people have acted without guilt, you know, without regard or concern for the consequences of their actions. So guilt is the extraordinary emotion that enables us to develop a conscience and therefore actually to be compassionate, empathic human beings. So as I said, guilt's a good example of the health and the unhealth in an emotion. You know, disappointment is another one. I think disappointment, I said before, it can be a real derailer. But actually, disappointment is giving you good information. If you go and set out to do something or you're involved in something and something happens that leaves you feeling very disappointed, you know, in a way, if you can press a pause button and listen to that disappointment, you know, it will help you to work out what you need to do next. If you are disappointed by something and it's an unhealthy situation, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It means there's an unhealthy situation and you need to take an action that will kind of change that situation or take you in a different direction. So again, understanding disappointment is a really, really valuable way of starting to learn to use that emotion to navigate your life in a way that's going to actually be heavily involved in a life of self-care, where you're making decisions that are right for you.
That brings me to a really good question, because you mentioned this idea of self-care quite a bit in your book. Can you explain what self-care actually means and why would that be important to us?
Okay, so self-care, as far as I can see, is a real gift, because I think if we don't look after ourselves, then it's quite challenging, you know, to navigate life. When we look after ourselves, we will inevitably have an abundance to give to others, because we are sitting in a sort of a place of good health within ourselves. So in terms of emotional health and mental health, self-care is really paramount. It means that we take responsibility for ourselves as a starting point. It means that we develop and live in a way that enhances our self-awareness. It means that we are recognizing both our potential and our limitations in a very real way. You know, self-care is, as I said, it's a very primary driver in our ability to develop healthy self-esteem. You know, if we are, for example, an overgiver, I mean, lots and lots of very empathic, wonderfully emotionally aware people are overgivers. They look after everybody else, but they don't look after themselves. And this actually makes them quite vulnerable. It means they're quite vulnerable to people who are maybe takers in life, who are looking for someone to lean on too heavily. You know, learning to say no appropriately is a big part of self-care. You know, quite often people who are overgivers will say yes when really they need to say no. And, you know, we can end up burning out if we're giving too much, if we're not looking after ourselves, you know, and that can also lead to underlying resentments as well if we are, you know, not prioritizing our own well-being. If we were to say take an imaginary line and we had selfish at one end and selfless at the other end, neither are very healthy. We need to be somewhere in the middle. You know, that would be a healthy position to be, and self-care would keep us somewhere in the middle, and we'll never be static on that line, because life circumstances will happen. You know, if you have a lot going on in your life, then it would be very, very important to be perhaps erring on the slightly more selfish scale. Whereas actually, if everything in your life is running really, really well, you'll have more to give. So you can move a little bit nearer the selfless end of the scale. But we never want to be completely selfless because we're not taking care of ourselves, nor do we want to be completely selfish because we're then not taking care of anybody else either.
Yes, I know some people like that in my own life who are that way, who are the givers, you know, the selfless givers, and will devote at any opportunity their total time and concentration almost in a saint-like manner, altruistically devote their entire time to someone until that relationship ends, usually in death, to be honest, you know, that kind of caregiver. And then when there is no one else left to care for, they often fall into a deep depression because they forgot to care for themselves and don't even know how to begin to do that. And important.
No, it's very, very interesting. I think you're absolutely right. And we can become so involved in being a carer that becomes our identity. You know, and as you said, then when there's no one left to care for, we don't quite know who we are without that. And I also think, you know, giving is a wonderful gift. I mean, it really, really is. But, you know, in a way, if we only give to others and we don't allow ourselves to receive, we deprive other people of the opportunity to, you know, and the joy to give to us. You know, I think, you know, leading a balanced life is a much healthier position where, you know, the giving and receiving and the joy of that is available for all parties.
Absolutely, especially today. I think that is so true. Now, of these emotions that you talk about in your book, is there anyone that you felt was particularly more challenging than the rest?
I would say probably despair. If someone is experiencing despair, the value of despair is that actually it's a serious wake-up call. You know, you mentioned, you know, people who sink into depression. Despair is a big part of depression. And in many ways, when people reach a place of despair, you know, we know that things have gone very badly wrong somewhere along the line. And, you know, I think despair is almost like it's a bit like a tapestry of lots of other emotions. If I was to describe it visually, it would be like a patchwork quilt of maybe the more challenging emotions that we have stitched together in a blanket that kind of shrouds us, you know, and it blocks out the light. You know, we can't see a way forwards. You know, we struggle to find hope and to see possibility. And so it's intrinsically connected to depression. To my mind, when we experience despair, this is a big wake-up call. We need to really think about how to listen to ourselves, you know, how to develop. I actually, in the exercise, I talk about developing a package of self-care where we use all kinds of methods to actually start to listen to ourselves and start to pay attention to what we actually need and to give ourselves the support that we need. I mean, very often people in a state of despair become quite shut down and they become quite isolated. So I think in terms of working with emotions, this is perhaps the one that gives me the greatest cause for concern. But there are things that we can do if we're experiencing despair. And in the chapter about it, I've kind of talked about the commonest, you know, causes, as well as some real valuable tools that will help you to kind of shift from that position.
In terms of your observations as a therapist for the past 20 plus years, do you find that any of these more challenging emotions, do you find that there's been an increase in them and occurring in our society as a whole?
That's an interesting question. In some ways, I don't know whether there is an increase or not. I think that we have a greater awareness now of challenging emotions, and we have a greater awareness of the need for emotional literacy and the need for, you know, emotional intelligence, you know, in terms of, let's say, my parents' generation was virtually unheard of. So I think we have a greater awareness of it. Though the one thing I would say is I think we see people's emotions flaring up, and we see a lot of reactive behavior around at the moment in our current time, and which would indicate that people are getting more and more wound up. People are getting more and more pent up. You know, they're struggling with pent up feelings and they're lashing out. So, I mean, maybe it's on an increase. I don't know. It's hard to say, but I do think we have a greater awareness of the importance of emotional literacy, and the more that we develop emotional literacy, and the less likely we are to see this emotionally reactive behavior. And I mean, it presents so many social challenges. So it's a really important area. And going back to self-care and self-responsibility, you know, we can't change other people, of course. We can't be responsible for other people, but we can be responsible for ourselves, and we can also set an example to other people in managing our emotions better.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We can't change somebody else. We can try and engage in a conversation if we are experiencing an emotionally challenging situation with another person, but we can't ultimately change the other person. But we can, of course, decide what we're going to do about it, and we can take charge of ourselves.
In your years of counseling, do you find that there is an inherently different approach to expressing or communicating emotions between men and women?
I would say this is again quite interesting. I've certainly come across a lot of men who I think have been brought up to believe that showing any kind of emotions is a weakness. And you know, working with couples, you know, I have a lot of sadness around that, because very often, you know, the female, you know, the woman in the couple, you know, in a heterosexual couple is sort of longing to share her partner's feelings and hear how he feels. And he's kind of, you know, quite closed down. And it's that sort of, you know, boys don't cry kind of attitude, really. So I think there are differences, but I also think that's changing. I think we are getting much, much better at being emotionally expressive and giving permission to ourselves, both for men and women. And it is interesting, you know, in my practice, I have seen as many men as I have women in my counseling practice. So that is quite interesting to me, because when I started my training, which was a long, long time ago, I remember, you know, one of the trainers saying to me, you know, we tend to see more women because they feel more able to come and talk about their feelings. Actually, I've seen probably 50-50. So it's interesting. There are as many guys out there who struggle, but who are hopefully beginning to feel that it really is actually okay to kind of come and look at the way that they feel.
I wonder if it's also because a man may feel safer going to someone who's, you know, a professional listener versus trying to get a spouse, their significant other.
Yeah.
Because then there seems to be an embroiled situation that could happen, you know.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think there is something, I mean, in reality, of course, for all of us, there's something, you know, very helpful about sometimes seeing a professional person. But I agree, I think maybe if for a guy who's been brought up to sort of believe that it's not okay to talk about his feelings, then I think going to see a professional person, it makes it much more accessible, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
And you're right. I mean, actually, I always love working with couples. It's quite interesting. I remember doing my very first training in couples counseling many, many years ago. And the trainer, she said, as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you've got a couple who are, you know, struggling with a particular issue, you know, if you work with an individual, you're only ever going to hear one side of the story. Actually, when you have both people sitting with you, your quid's in, because you're going to, you know, it's going to happen right there in front of you. You're going to see how they interact. You're going to see how they kind of dance together. And I mean, she was absolutely right. I have to say, I love working with couples. It's wonderful to get, again, it's the element of emotional education that comes into it, when a couple can really begin to understand themselves and offer one another a level of support with real emotional awareness. I mean, you know that they head off into their future with such a strong foundation between them. It's absolutely wonderful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That would be such a heartwarming thing to experience, and so encouraging as well, because then they too can pass on that same type of awareness to others around them. Their relationship will influence others.
Absolutely. And you know, again, especially when a couple have children, it filters out. It's very, very interesting. But I think emotional awareness does filter out. I think back to this sort of self-responsibility, the more that we develop our own awareness, our own ways of being with our emotions. Emotions are up and running all the time. You know, our human lives are not just about the way that we think. They're about the way that we feel. And so actually, the more we understand our emotions and the more kind of emotionally fluent we become, it just makes a huge difference to the quality of our lives. And that then ripples out to the people around us.
Let me go to my next question, which is based off of this idea of emotions and thoughts. You mention in your book that they are interlaced. And so my question to you is, which one triggers first, sort of like the chicken or the egg, right? Is it the thought and then the emotion? Or do you think the emotion gets triggered and then the thought develops after that?
I suspect it's both. I know exactly what you mean with the chicken and the egg. I suspect it is both, because if you are in a very negative frame of mind, that will absolutely generate, you know, some more challenging emotions. But likewise, I mean, if you're feeling, you know, stressed and unhappy, that's going to change the kind of thinking patterns that you have. It's going to generate more negative thoughts. I guess the key for me is whenever we're involved in any kind of negative feelings or thoughts, you know, and thinking patterns, is really to recognize that before we kind of head into a downward spiral where thoughts and feelings are feeding one another and taking us into a kind of more challenging space within ourselves. As I said, I'm never sure which comes first. It's a challenge, isn't it? But I guess the key is really to be able to listen to both and take an action of some sort that's going to help with that.
It really would depend on the situation that is causing that kind of reaction. But I would also think that if there is a constant grappling of that emotion, let's say anger, if you're constantly reacting with anger first, before you even realize why, I would imagine that in that particular case, you're carrying a lot of anger, and that's your go-to emotion that you then respond to whatever's happening, you know, through that tint, if that makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head there, which is if we are carrying a build-up, emotions build up if we don't kind of take appropriate action in response to them. So actually, if you have, you know, a little bit cross or a little bit angry, you know, and you never, ever, ever listen to that, you never, ever take an appropriate action, you know, that anger is going to stack up and stack up and stack up. And then, you know, something quite small can happen and we can explode. And it's as though, you know, it's not just the something that just happened. It's the 50 things previously that we didn't actually kind of check in on. I mean, I think if we have a residue of almost like sort of past situations that have caused us to feel a particular emotion and we've never really dealt with it, they will build up. I mean, we know that if you bottle up your feelings, it doesn't do you any good. And I mean, anger is classic in that respect, that, you know, I mean, also, of course, some people really don't know how to manage anger. And so they become really fearful of their anger. Again, that sometimes people lash out. Sometimes people turn that anger in on themselves and they really, really beat themselves up internally. Either way, we really need to kind of, if we are finding ourselves sitting with any emotion in an ongoing kind of way where it's really taking up a lot of our sort of internal space, we really do need to do something about that.
Is this part of what you call repetitive thought syndrome, or is that something different?
Repetitive thought syndrome, it's a sort of a term that I've kind of used because I think that we all have like an internal dialogue, you know, a conversation in our mind. And that's just part of being a human being. But repetitive thought syndrome is really where you end up kind of repeating the same thought patterns over and over and over again. And those repetitive thoughts can really tie us in knots. They tend to be quite negative, actually. I mean, it would be wonderful if you have repetitive thought syndrome that was, you know, constantly affirming you and, you know, was really, really positive. But for most people, they often have a repetitive kind of thinking pattern that tends to be negative. And it's heavily influenced by our emotions. So actually, again, during the book, when I've talked about various different emotions, I've talked about repetitive thought syndrome, and I've kind of talked about the kind of repeating thoughts that are associated with each particular emotion. So again, it helps us to understand again what we can do to change that.
Can you give us one example of a repetitive thought that is connected with one of the challenging emotions?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think anxiety is, let's use that as an example. Repetitive thinking around anxiety means we tend to anticipate disaster. You know, we tend to anticipate catastrophe. So the repetitive thoughts will often be focused on what I would call, they're like what if thoughts. What if this goes wrong? Then that will happen. And then that will happen. And then that will happen. And so lots of what if thinking. it means that we are investing a huge amount of time trying to work out what might happen rather than what actually is happening. You know, we're kind of trapped in, as I said, a repetitive mode of thinking that, interestingly enough, tends to fuel further anxiety. It creates more of the same because we're creating more and more worry and more concern.
Do you think there is a way, because you did discuss this in your previous podcast about millennials and the current generation and technology, but do you believe that there is a better way for us to become connected emotionally through technology?
It's an interesting area because there are lots and lots of concerns, I think, that people are growing up in a world where communication is so involved with technology that we lose our ability just to be in relationship with one another. However, I also do think that, and I talked about this in the last podcast, you know, I've come across people, I have colleagues now who do a lot of online counseling, and it's been really, really interesting because some of the people who come forward would not actually have the confidence to come and talk to somebody kind of face to face. So it can actually give them access to someone who can talk with them about their emotions, for example, and maybe they might build up to a meeting face to face. So I think it swings in roundabouts. I think there are pluses and minuses. I think there's a danger if people only communicate through technology that they actually cease to or they don't develop any confidence in developing, you know, real relationships with people. You know, I think we don't want technology to take over to the point where we don't actually sit with one another and talk as well. On the other hand, I do think that we can make connections with people who have maybe experienced similar experiences, support groups, that kind of thing. So as I said, I think it goes both ways, really. I guess if we are mindful about how we use technology and we use it in a really, really useful and valuable way, then it can only be good. The challenge is, of course, to kind of manage the more negative side of things.
If you notice, there is a big trend of these AI types of devices, in your personal robot, for example, and how more and more we're seeing that they are not only task-oriented, but they are developing more of an empathic appeal to them, where they become more sensitive to your tone of voice, for example, and respond to you with different intonations and try to create an emotional, empathic relationship with you. Do you think that this is a healthy direction, or do you think, again, that, you know, we need to be careful here with completely relying on a technical device for interaction?
I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the potential challenge within that. Of course, anything that we use, if it's anything that involves empathy, is going to actually be valuable because the more that we develop empathy, the better. I mean, it's kindness and empathy are something that is much needed in humanity generally. I guess, again, if people who maybe are lacking in human contact are still at least getting some connection to an empathic experience, that can only be good. On the other hand, I think we need to be really mindful that technology doesn't become a substitute for real relationships. I mean, loneliness is on the up. I did a couple of radio shows with the BBC last year to do with loneliness, and it's really on the increase. And I think there's a real danger that technology kind of takes over, and rather than going out and being with other people, you know, we become perhaps more and more isolated, which is, you know, really not going to be helpful for us.
Very true. Now, we do have a caller, Sharon from Tennessee, who is a 67-year-old grandmother whose only son lives with his family in Connecticut, and they want her to visit and stay for at least a month, I guess because of, you know, the distance there. And she says the problem is she is having is that she really wants to see them, to be with her family, but Maybe we can relate to this, but her grandchildren are undisciplined and unruly. And so when she tries to discipline them, when she visits, when they visit her in her home, her son, you know, tells her it's not her place to do so. And so she is very dedicated to her son and to her family, but she's feeling very anxious about being around his three children who are all under the age of six. Her question is, should she do, quote, the right thing and go, or should she find an excuse not to go? She's feeling very stressed about this situation. Do you have any advice for her?
Well, this is really, really interesting because my first thought immediately was, I love the inverted commas really around the right thing. You know, what is the right thing? I would really be wanting Sharon to listen to her anxiety. We don't get anxious for nothing. And I hear that, you know, there's been, I guess, a little bit of confrontation with her son around how we discipline the children. But I'm wondering if she could actually share something of her anxiety with her son. You know, it's very interesting. And there's a technique in the book about this, about actually managing conversations that we think might be confrontational, that we're anxious about. I think if we always start with voicing something, so for example, if I were putting myself in her shoes and I said to my son, you know, I'm really not okay with the children and so on and so forth, I might get quite a defensive response. But if I were to bring it back to myself and say, look, I'm feeling really anxious about this visit and I'd really like to talk to you about this, and I'm wondering if you could help me with this a little bit, that's a very different kind of approach. You know, when we own our emotion and we voice it to someone else and we ask them to help us with that, we're very often going to get a far more responsive approach from the other person. Whereas if she sort of said, you know, I'm really, you know, fed up with the way that your children behave, or, you know, that's going to generate a kind of a defensive response. Or if she said, I don't agree with the way that you're disciplining your children or not disciplining them. But I think if she could talk about her anxiety to her son and actually share that feeling with him, it may enable something of a conversation to take place. Because I guess, you know, to go and stay somewhere for a month, I don't know that there's a right thing or a wrong thing, but to stay anywhere for a month where we're not okay and we're not happy isn't really going to be very good for our self-care. But likewise, actually not seeing her son at all and his family might also not be very good. I mean, maybe there needs to be some boundaries and some contracting almost. I know that sounds quite a formal word, but, you know, a relationship, every relationship actually is a kind of contract. And, you know, when we, I guess, in any of our relationships, we don't necessarily contract clearly. We don't always say to somebody what matters to us, and we don't always ask them to help look after the things that matter to us, and vice versa. So, you know, I'd be really wanting to encourage her to have a non-confrontational discussion with her son, but to talk about her anxiety, to ask him to help with that and see what he comes back with. Because it sounds as though she does have a close relationship with him. It doesn't sound as though this is a challenging relationship or has been a challenging relationship before. She sounds like a very dedicated mum and a dedicated grandma as well. So, I'd be really wanting to encourage her to talk about this anxiety with him from that position of ownership. I mean, maybe if she's staying, there needs to be some kind of rule around her taking time out. You know, if she's not going to discipline the kids at all, maybe, you know, there needs to be some boundaries around, you know, her room, for example, that when she stays, you know, actually that she takes some time out for herself. Or I don't know, but you know, to me, I'd really want to, yeah, see whether a conversation can take place, but starting with sharing that anxiety with him and just saying, I'm really anxious and I'd like to talk to you about it. And I'm wondering if you can help me with this.
Two points that you make that I really love is the fact that, yes, You're right. Relationships are a contract, and everybody needs reassurance that people are, you know, sort of know what they're supposed to do and how to follow through, and that there's open communication. But the other one that I really love is a timeout. You know, that's what's missing in our lives, an adult timeout. We used to put our children in timeout and think that we were punishing them. But now, as an adult, I'd like somebody to tell me to go in timeout just so I have some peace and quiet,
yeah,
right? For about 10 minutes. That's so funny. That is interesting.
But you're absolutely right, though. I mean, it is this back to self-care. You know, it's like back to taking responsibility for what I need and recognizing that actually, you know, I mean, to sit down and say, you know, I mean, you know, we're using Sharon, you know, as a wonderful example, actually. Thank you, Sharon, for kind of calling in with this. But, you know, it's about saying, you know, actually, look, this is what I need for my well-being. You know, how can we kind of work this one through? You know, how can we do this so that, and again, it's about mutual respect, isn't it? I mean, it is wonderful to share something of ourselves, to share our anxiety, and to ask our needs to be respected. And to also, whilst respecting the needs of the other, you know, as opposed to just getting into that critical mode where it feels like he doesn't do this with his kids or whatever, you know, and that confrontation is unnecessary if we can enter into this really respectful level of kind of communication with an awareness of one another's feelings. You know, and again, if she's sort of saying, you know, I really respect the fact that you're bringing your kids up in the way that you feel is right for you, but I also know that I need to kind of, you know, as we've said, take some time out sometimes. And so it's kind of just working out what the boundaries are going to be and doing so in a way that really offers respect to one another.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Goes back to that respect. Now, you indicate that this second book, you sort of give us a little tease here, is part of a series of books on emotional intelligence. Should we be expecting another one in the near future?
Yes, you should, actually. The next book in the series is about building self-esteem. And it's something that I have come across so many times. So many people have low self-esteem. And, you know, it's self-esteem and confidence get kind of lumped together, but they're actually very different. You know, people can be very, very confident outwardly. You know, we can learn confidence. We can develop confidence in different areas. It doesn't mean that we feel good about ourselves inside. You know, I mean, actually, Robin Williams is a really classic example in that respect. I would imagine self-esteem was quite a challenge for him. We see it a lot, actually, in you know, high levels of confidence in high achievers, but they still don't really ever reward themselves, feel good about themselves, or they may have a real internal struggle going on. And actually, just in an everyday way, lots and lots of people struggle with self-esteem. So the next book is about building, really teaching people to build a permanent sense of self-value and self-worth. It'll be in the same format, this, you know, 20 minutes, 20, 25 minutes a day for 7 days of reading with invitations and exercises. And I am thinking about running a course alongside the next book too, because our self-esteem is very dependent. We build self-esteem through relationship. And so actually, I love the idea of actually running a course and setting up a kind of a community. I mean, can you imagine a global community of people who are supporting each other in, you know, developing their emotional awareness, because emotions are so intrinsically connected to self-esteem. You know, a community of people helping each other to deepen their emotional awareness, develop communication skills, and supporting each other, you know, again, in healthy self-care with real respect for others, with an awareness of the consequences of our actions. So that's kind of where I'm going with that. And hopefully around Easter time, I'll be launching that book.
Oh, that'll be wonderful. Now, are we supposed to read these books in sequence?
You can. They do stand alone, actually, in their own right. So, but they are, in a sense, written in a sequence. So the first book obviously is about spiritual empathy. That is about learning to listen to yourself and and really to life itself. And so that is a wonderful foundation before you then go on to deepen your emotional awareness in Mindfulness Meets Emotional Awareness. But they are standalone books in their own right, so we don't have to read them in a sequence.
Well, these sound like very exciting projects ahead that's going to benefit so many people. And I'm wondering, aside from the new book, do you have any other future plans, and how can our listeners learn more about you?
Okay, well, the books, the first two books will be coming out in audio soon. So that's, and that will be literally within the next month. So for people who wish to listen and enjoy listening, there are also various other things that I do. I have a library, an online library called the A to Z of Emotional Health. This is an audio and video library. It's a completely free public resource. I started making audios many, many years ago for some of the people I was working with, because in between sessions, they were kind of really wanting to touch base and, you know, perhaps reinforce some of the things that we were talking about in terms of concepts and subject. So I started making audios, and I just decided to create an online library with these audios and meditations as well that help with emotional awareness and with emotional resolution, you know, if we've got challenges going on. So this is, as I said, a completely free public resource. It's just a contribution that I wanted to make. So that's available, and that's ongoing. There are, you know, uploads on a regular basis of blogs, audios, videos, so people can access that at any time.
Can you share again with us your URL and your website?
Certainly. So the library is the A to Z of Emotional Health.com. So that's www.a-z-of-emotionalhealth.com. It's a bit of a mouthful, but you can also connect to it through my personal website, which is jennyflorencehealth.com. Again, if you want to kind of just keep in touch, if you sign up, I don't share email addresses with anyone, and you won't hear from me. I know I get inundated with emails from people that I sign up to. I only send out emails when something's actually going into the library or something's actually happening. So, you know, if you get an email from me, you won't get weekly ones, but when you do get them, I'll have something to share with you that's there and available. And also, I mean, you can connect up to me through Twitter, JennyFlorence1. And the A to Z of Emotional Health also has its own Facebook page. So anything new in the library gets posted there too.
So that's wonderful, because now folks can reach out to you in a variety of ways and also be able to enrich their own lives with the very real life advice that you give them on how to be more emotionally mindful. And so I would like to thank you again, Jenny, for joining me today. And we love the fact that you've been with us, and I hope we'll bring you back to perhaps discuss your new book.
That would be absolutely fabulous, and it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, Monique.
And thank you for joining me, your host, Monique, on the Emotions Matter podcast.